Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Saturday, the 22nd of July. President Biden nominates Admiral Lisa Franchetti to run the US Navy. If confirmed, she'll be the first woman to serve as a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. More than 1,000 Israeli Air Force reservists say they will stop reporting for duty if the government goes ahead with plans to curb the power of judges. And an infamous Russian ultra-nationalist is arrested. Also in the podcast, long overshadowed by the narcos, we hear about the narcas, the women playing a key role in Latin America's drug cartels. And
the most important element of Tony Bennett's career was his voice. So it was the emotional resonance that defied all generational and demographic and geographical barriers.
As tributes pour in for the music legend Tony Bennett, we hear what made him so special. After her nomination by President Biden on Friday, Admiral Lisa Franchetti could become the first woman to lead the US Navy and the first to serve as a member of the US Joint Chiefs of Staff. A former head of both the US 6th Fleet and US Naval Forces in Korea, she's also served as an aircraft carrier strike commander. President Biden noted the historical significance of her selection and said throughout her career, Admiral Franchetti has demonstrated extensive expertise in both the operational and policy arenas. However, securing her confirmation in the Senate may not be straightforward. Our North America correspondent David Willis has been telling my colleague Alex Ritson more about her.
No woman has risen this high, Alex, in the ranks of the US military. Lisa Franchetti is a 38-year military veteran. She would not only be the first woman in the history of this country to lead the US Navy, she would also be the first woman to become a member of that elite group of senior military officers who serve as advisors to the president and comprise what's known as the Joint Chiefs of Staff. She's a high flyer, there's no question about that, and she's only the second woman to achieve the rank of four-star admiral in the US Navy. She's served on a series of surface vessels, commanding a guided missile destroyer, and she was deputy commander of US naval forces in Europe and Africa and appointed vice chief of naval operations just last September. So she has quite a pedigree.
And her nomination by Joe Biden is at odds with what his defense secretary Lloyd Austin wanted.
So it would appear multiple reports here in the US media suggest that Lisa Franchetti was not the first choice of the US Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, who recommended Top Gun graduate Samuel Paparo as the next Navy chief instead. And Admiral Paparo has instead been nominated as the next commander of the US Pacific Fleet. President Biden doesn't seem in any doubt about his decision, however. He issued a statement today commending Lisa Franchetti for what he called her extensive expertise both on shore and at sea.
What's the process from here?
Well, Lisa Franchetti is due to take up her new position next month when the admiral that she is due to succeed, Admiral Mike Gilday, stands down. But her nomination has still to be confirmed by the Senate. And Republicans, one Republican in particular, in fact, Senator Tommy Tuberville, are currently blocking military appointments in protest at a policy that pays the travel expenses of service members who have to go out of state in order to have an abortion. Now, currently, more than 200 senior military nominations are stalled. So it's unclear if the Senate will actually confirm Lisa Franchetti by the time her predecessor leaves office. Now, today, President Biden took aim at Senator Tuberville in his statement, saying that delaying the approval of military nominees was not only wrong, it was dangerous. And he went on to say, in this moment of rapidly evolving security environments and intense competition, He, the senator, is risking our ability to ensure that the United States armed forces remain the greatest fighting force in the history of the world.
Our North America correspondent David Willis. A dictatorship versus a military junta. The two sides in the standoff over Israeli government plans to curb the power of judges are not mincing their words over the threats they see from their rivals. After months of protests, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is hoping to secure the first stage of his reforms in Parliament early next week. But in a sign of the strength of opposition, more than 1,000 military reservists are threatening to refuse to turn up for duty unless there's a rethink, potentially undermining Israel's security. I heard more about the standoff from our Middle East editor, Sebastian Usher.
It's probably the biggest card that the opposition to the judicial overhaul has so far played, and it's doing it as the clock ticks right down with one of the most contentious bills due to have its second and third reading and a vote expected in the Israeli parliament to pass it early next week, just before the Knesset breaks up for the summer recess. So I think it's no accident that it's been produced now. The reason why it's a strong card, this is probably the most important group of reservists so far to make their position clear. These are reservists who are in the Air Force, including hundreds of pilots, including people essentially who make up, according to some estimates, maybe half of the air combat preparedness of the Israeli military. So that is being taken very seriously. The Defense Minister, Yoav Gallant, has been meeting heads of the coalition, this very far-right coalition that the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu leads, to try and get what the reservists are asking for. What these reservists say in their letter essentially is that the government is being unreasonable and that it's breaking the consent, the trust on which their wish to risk their lives is based. And they're saying with that gone, they won't report for duty.
And what is in this bill that the government hopes to get through next week? And why are opponents so concerned about it?
From the perspective of those who are pushing through these reforms, they'll say that that evens out the power differential between the judiciary and the government, which they believe is too much in favour of the judiciary at the moment, that it has too much power. What the protesters say, what the reservists are saying, is that it potentially gives a government the ability to act like a dictatorship and therefore is a threat to Israel's democratic ideals, which Israelis still do believe in.
Our Middle East regional editor, Sebastian Usher. Donald Trump is the clear front-runner to become the Republican candidate in the November 2024 presidential election. The nominee will be formally chosen in a series of primary votes across the US in the first half of next year. However, we now know that Mr. Trump will face several trials during that time, including one over his alleged mishandling of classified documents stored at his home in Florida. The judge, Trump-appointed Eileen Cannon, has decided the case will start in May, even though the former president had asked for it to be postponed until after the election. Our correspondent Nomia Iqbal is following developments from Washington.
So the date is set for May the 20th next year, and it's slap bang in the middle of the election campaign season. The date actually puts the trial at the tail end of the Republican Party's presidential primary process. So I think it's guaranteed, certainly right now, that Donald Trump is probably going to be the nominee. He's the clear front runner for the nomination. And just to remind people what this trial is about. So he faces 37 counts of allegedly withholding classified documents relating to national security. He's charged alongside his aide with also making false statements and conspiring to obstruct justice. He has pleaded not guilty to all the charges. Just to give you his reaction today, he says that the schedule is a setback for the Department of Justice. Of course, they're the ones that brought the case forward. And he says the delay gives an extensive time to fight what he describes as an empty hoax. Because Donald Trump wants a delay until after the presidential election. So this trial would happen 6 months before Americans start voting. He wants it to happen after that because the Department of Justice, basically, they can't prosecute a sitting president. And his legal advisers have been pretty much blunt about that fact that they want to kick this into the long grass.
Nomia Iqbal in Washington. At the start of the invasion of Ukraine, anti-war criticism inside Russia was swiftly silenced. However, nationalists backing the offensive were allowed to speak out over what they saw as the inept handling of the conflict. The most high profile of these so-called military bloggers is Igor Girkin, a.k.a. Commander Strelkov. In 2014, he helped Russia annex Crimea and led pro-Kremlin insurgents in the Donbass in eastern Ukraine. He was also found guilty in absentia by a Dutch court over the shooting down of Malaysia Airlines flight MH17. But on Friday, just days after calling on President Putin to hand over power, the blogger was arrested and charged in Moscow, as our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg explains.
Mr. Girkin's wife revealed that her husband had been detained while she was out. She didn't know where he'd been taken. Later in the day, it emerged that he'd been arrested. He was brought to a Moscow court and charged with extremism. He told the judge that he had heart problems and asked for house arrest, but in the end, the judge remanded him in custody at least until the 18th of September. The maximum sentence on those charges is 5 years in prison.
I mean, how significant is it that a figure like this, who is a strong nationalist, has a lot of supporters, that he has been detained?
I think it is significant. Ever since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, we've seen thousands of Russians being detained and prosecuted for expressing anti-war sentiments. But the arrest of Mr. Girkin is different. This shows that the Russian authorities are now losing patience with some of the most vocal supporters of the war, who have been criticising increasingly the Russian authorities for not going far enough in securing victory on the battlefield. People like Mr. Girkin. I mean, a few days ago he called the Kremlin leader a non-entity and a cowardly waste of space. That raised many eyebrows here. So perhaps not too surprising that he received a knock on the door from law enforcement officers today and ended up in court.
Is this a change in the internal strategy of the Kremlin?
As I say, I think the Kremlin is now losing patience with people from the sort of ultra-patriotic wing who had been allowed more freedom to criticise the authorities and to criticise the course of the war. But after the Wagner mutiny, that was a wake-up call from the Kremlin. Of course, there is a huge irony here because Igor Girkin had been super critical of Yevgeny Prigozhin, the Wagner chief. Mr. Prigozhin organises a mutiny, gets his fighters to march on the Russian capital, and he's still a free man. It'll be interesting to see what the reaction is amongst the sort of the patriotic wing of Russian society.
Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, in Moscow. This time yesterday on the Global News podcast, you may have heard about the search for a reported lioness on the outskirts of the German capital, Berlin. The hunt began after two people spotted what appeared to be a big cat chasing a wild boar down a street. Now there's been an important update from the authorities. Viviane Baumann, a reporter for the German channels NTV and RTL in Berlin, spoke to James Reynolds.
There was a massive police operation to look for this lioness. Everyone thought it's a lioness, but at the same time, different wildlife experts analyzed the little clip and they had a look at the proportion of the animal. And then they realized the legs were actually too thin for a lioness. And the back was actually very round, not very typical for a lioness as well. And the tail was too short. So today in a press conference, they presented us the news that the animal in the video probably is a boar.
And what kind of reaction has there been to the fact that not everyone was having to run away from a terrifying female lion, but from a rather more common wild boar?
A massive relief. People in that area, they know that there are a lot of boars in their forests, so they're used to that. Everyone is a little bit laughing about the story as well here in Berlin, because it was quite a crazy thing to know that there should be a lioness in our forest. But at the same time, the mayor of the area where the lioness was found said we had to take that situation very serious. We had the video, and at the same time, when the police started looking in the forests, two police officers said they also saw something like a lioness. So they had to really take it serious. They had to look with hunters, with different vets. They had to walk around in the forest with their guns. But of course, now there is a massive relief. And also, the taxpayers are not really happy. They have to pay for such a big operation.
Is that it then? Is this wild boar at the centre of this sort of hoax chase? No one needs to chase that wild boar. The boar just lives in the forest and that's that.
So at the moment, the police operations stop. People can leave their houses again. And we have the summertime here, so everyone wants to go outside. And now this is possible again. So the police said the area is safe. You can go outside. This lioness story was a bit crazy and we're all happy it's just a boar.
German reporter Viviane Baumann talking to James Reynolds. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
we're still one of the most corrupt countries on earth. Just the level of not just greed, but the in-your-face flaunting these wealth in the face of poverty is incredible.
We report from Cambodia ahead of Sunday's general election. President Biden has secured a pledge from American tech giants to provide voluntary safeguards over the risks of artificial intelligence. Seven companies, including Google, Meta, Amazon and Microsoft, have committed themselves to moves such as developing watermarking technology to identify AI-generated content. The US president spoke about his concerns at a meeting with the tech leaders at the White House.
We'll see more technology change in the next 10 years or even in the next few years than we've seen in the last 50 years. Artificial intelligence is going to transform the lives of people around the world. Social media has shown us the harm that powerful technology can do without the right safeguards in place. We must be clear-eyed and vigilant about the threats of emerging technologies that can pose, don't have to, but can pose to our democracy and our values.
So, will these measures make the U.S. a safer AI environment? Michelle Fleury is our U.S. business correspondent.
The way to look at this really is as a first step. There is a general agreement, both from the companies, but also from politicians, and more broadly, I think, within society, that AI products present lots of opportunities, but they also present risks. And this is an attempt to try and set some rules of the road. So we have things like security testing, allowing new products to be kind of vetted, third-party reporting of vulnerabilities. Perhaps the most significant thing, the idea of marking AI-generated content, something like a watermark, if it's been created by AI versus sort of, you know, organically. That would help fight things like disinformation. So when you consider that, you know, we're about a year or so away from an election here in the United States, a kind of very important point. But it doesn't carry the force of law, and that is the job of Congress. So, like I say, it is just a first step.
Yeah, where does this fit in with possible eventual regulation?
Well, we know that Congress and lawmakers are interested in crafting some rules. But again, because of the US presidential election and because of how divided Congress is, the likelihood of something being done before that is pretty minimal. We've seen earlier this week, you had the UN National Security Council hold their first meeting on kind of the risks posed by AI. They are talking about whether or not some global body, a bit like the International Atomic Energy Body, should be created. This is really early stages, but I think that is the direction of travel.
Our North America business correspondent, Michelle Fleury. People in Cambodia go to the polls on Sunday, but the outcome of the election is already known. Hun Sen, one of the world's longest-serving political leaders, is guaranteed to win. He styles himself a strongman and has been prime minister since 1985. A UN-led operation saw democracy restored in the 1990s, after Cambodia was all but destroyed by revolution and civil war. But since then, Hun Sen has seen off opponents by co-opting, jailing, exiling or sidelining them. It's left many Cambodians feeling they have no voice in the election, as our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head reports.
All the colour and noise of an Asian election campaign, but missing an essential ingredient, competition. This is the triumphant final rally of the Cambodian People's Party, whose leader Hun Sen has run the country for nearly 40 years, and he's not about to loosen his grip now. Chandani Watawala is the executive director of the Asian Network for Free Elections, which sends monitors to pretty much every big election in this region. But with the main opposition Candlelight Party barred from contesting, she says they're not coming to Cambodia.
It is a show. No choice for the people. No choice for who believe in the democratic elections.
Leading members of the Candlelight Party have been arrested. Some have now fled into exile. One of those is Musa Kua, a former MP and government minister who's now in the United States.
We should call it a selection for Mr. Hun Sen to select his successor. He has to make it more than 100% sure that his son will be selected by his own party as the next prime minister of Cambodia.
Musakur and other opposition figures keep calling on Western countries, who largely funded the reconstruction of Cambodia after the devastation of the Khmer Rouge and civil war, to sanction Hun Sen and his party. But the CPP spokesman Sok Isan ridicules this notion. You in the West called our last election a sham, he says. Yet afterwards, Hun Sen was given a red carpet welcome in Washington. Given the US ambition to claw back influence from China in Cambodia, he's probably right to be cynical. But there are other long-term threats to Hun Sen's hold on this country.
For those of us, like me, who saw Cambodia 30 years ago in such a wretched state after the civil war, the pace of development, at least here in the capital, Phnom Penh, has been breathtaking. There are high-rise buildings going up all over the place and an astonishing number of luxury cars on the roads. But it is development that's often been unequal, unjust and unsustainable. Hun Sen likes to talk about his policies as being a win-win for the Cambodian people, but there are many of them who feel they've not been winning under his rule.
We drove 45 minutes north to meet Prak Supir and her neighbours. They live next to one of the many lakes you find in this low-lying area. Only much of their lake has been filled in with rubble by a well-connected property developer. And Prak Supir has been ordered to leave.
Hun Sen always talks about his win-win policy, but it is he alone who wins. We, the real Cambodian people who live on this land, are suffering in the name of development.
Land disputes are common in Cambodia, but they are just one of numerous combustible grievances caused by Hun Sen's model of development, which gives huge concessions to the business cronies who support him. Uvirak, founder of the think tank Future Forum, believes this flaw could ignite trouble in the future.
Since 1998, Cambodia has seen almost uninterrupted growth. But at the same time, we have seen crackdowns on opposition. We're still one of the most corrupt countries on earth. Just the level of not just greed, but the in-your-face, you know, flaunting these wealth in the face of poverty is incredible.
So will Hun Sen's son, Hun Manet, who's almost certain to succeed him, be able to rein in the excesses of his father's style of government? He's largely untested in this role, and in the roughhouse, sometimes violent politics of Cambodia, it's very likely he will run into difficulties.
Our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head reporting. From Colombia's Pablo Escobar to Joaquin Guzman, also known as El Chapo in Mexico, the murderous exploits of the kingpins of Latin America's drug cartels are well chronicled in books, TV shows like Narcos, and even songs. But what about the women? Well, Deborah Bonello, a longtime journalist in Latin America for Vice News, wants to set the record straight in her new book, Narcos, The Secret Rise of Women in Latin America's Cartels. She told Julian Marshall what motivated her to write about them.
The drug cartels and the violence around them was a part of my general beat as soon as I got to Mexico nearly 20 years ago. And what I found was that the way that women were portrayed in the trade was based on gender tropes. They were essentially either victims of organized crime as mules or trafficked women, or they were sort of these glamorous accessories of these big male legends, you know, the Chapos and the Escobars. It didn't make sense to me that the story of women in organized crime is that simple. And a lot of the women that I documented were very high ranking within either the Sinaloa cartel or other regional organizations. One of El Chapo's chief money launderers and his right-hand woman was a woman called Guadalupe Fernandez Valencia, who pleaded guilty in the US and she's doing her time. Throughout Central America, you saw women on borders between countries who were important transport providers for cocaine and other drugs coming up from Colombia on their way through Mexico to the US. And I found these women to be as capable of violence as their male counterparts. Some of them, they were brought into the business by their husbands or their family, you know, but then those women often went on to outperform the husbands and male predecessors that they were replacing.
And were they enforcers? Did they use guns?
It's important to understand that in organized crime, a lot of violence is outsourced. You rarely do it yourself.
Did you get to meet any of these women?
I did. I got to meet Maritza Lemus, who was a powerhouse based on the Guatemala-El Salvador border, quite notorious for her management of violence and kidnapping. Her and her sister had a very formidable reputation in that local town. Her sister was eventually assassinated and Maritza took up the reins. So I managed to get into prison to see her. She was a powerhouse. In the book, I talk about how her nemesis was the local mayor of her town, a guy who accused her of trying to have him killed three times. She denied that, but at the same time, she made it pretty clear how much she despised him, blamed him for the murder of her sister. When I told her how terrified the local mayor apparently was of her, she clearly loved it. She kind of smirked at that. I think it gave her some satisfaction. A lot of criminal prosecutors in the US have told me that women who then do end up in front of a judge tend to play on this grandmother taken advantage of or unwitting or kind of dumb participant when they're facing jail time.
A lot of the male leaders of drugs cartels, they're idolized. Does the same thing happen to the women?
I think the women who I investigated, in terms of their reputation in the places they operated, they were feared and respected in the same way. You know, the book, it's about the narrative of acknowledging the empowerment and rise of these women without celebrating it. The more clearly we see the role of women, arguably, the more effective policies could be construed to tackle the drug trade.
Deborah Bonello talking to Julian Marshall. Watership Down by English author Richard Adams tells the tale of a group of rabbits, Hazel, Fiver, Bigwig and their friends, as they try to find a new warren. It was turned into an animated film in the late 1970s. For some, it was a charming adventure. To others, though, it was a traumatic tale of peril and bloody battles. Now the British Board of Film Classification has judged that the movie, originally given a U or Universal rating, should no longer be classified as suitable for all. Here's our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson.
All is calm and peaceful in the meadow. Or is it?
For generations, children have been left traumatised by Watership Down.
The field, it's covered with blood.
The 1978 animated version of Richard Adams' novel about rabbits fleeing their endangered warren to find a new home was a huge box office hit, and Art Garfunkel's theme tune even spent 6 weeks at number one in the singles chart. But despite the softness of the song and TV often scheduling the film for an afternoon showing on Easter Sunday, Watership Down was seriously scary. Now 45 years after it was originally given a U certificate, meaning suitable for anyone aged 4 or over, Watership Down has become a PG. The film was resubmitted to the British Board of Film Classification for a re-release by the British Film Institute. The rabbits were revisited and the decision was made that a raise was required.
They will kill you.
The reasons given? Violence. A rabbit being caught in a snare, beginning to choke, and blood foaming from his mouth. Threatened horror.
We've got to go away from the warren. All of us.
Especially the implication that multiple rabbits are trapped in a tunnel and die. And language. Ah! With Kihar the gull dropping a swear word. When he became the boss of the BBFC in 2016, David Cross made it clear he thought Watership Down was a film whose ratings should be revised to PG.
I think that, according to modern standards, is a more appropriate classification. We didn't do large-scale public consultations back then, and things have evolved.
And now the change has happened. Watership Down has gone up.
Colin Patterson. Finally, tributes have been pouring in to the American singer Tony Bennett, who's died at the age of 96, as you may have heard in our earlier podcast. The former US First Lady Hillary Clinton described Tony Bennett as a true talent, while Elton John said he was without doubt the classiest singer, man and performer you'd ever see. The music journalist Jonathan Wingate knew Tony Bennett well and told me what he was like as a person.
The very thought of you.
Tony Bennett had an unquenchable thirst for the new. He was always looking forward, always enthusiastic about everything. And this kind of ran through his life like a stick of rock. I remember him saying to me, always shoot for the best. The best clothes, the best music, the best art, the best food. He lived his life with this idea of purity and truth running through it. That kind of said everything about him. But he was also very funny, had a wry sense of humour, always laughing. And he had a zest for life that I've never seen in anybody else.
I know I'd go from rags to riches if you would only say you care.
And was that zest for life what enabled him to have such a long and successful career?
I think it was in part that, but the centre of Tony's career, or the most important element of Tony Bennett's career, was his voice. So it was the emotional resonance of his voice that defied all generational and demographic and geographical barriers. And so if you heard that voice, you couldn't fail to be moved. You'd have to have a stone for a heart not to find that moving and spine tingling, because he was a singer's singer. In a sense, he hated the idea of being called a crooner. He felt that was reductive, and he saw himself as a jazz singer, and he sang very much like a musician played. He sang with such an innate understanding of jazz music, but he took that into the mainstream. Jazz is not a mainstream genre, but he made the Great American Songbook appeal to successive generations and took it to the top of the charts all over the world.
And able to perform with other legends, Frank Sinatra, Aretha Franklin, and more in the modern day, Amy Winehouse and Lady Gaga.
Yeah, and that was because he was just attracted to great people. I remember him telling me he thought Lady Gaga would be as great a singer as Ella Fitzgerald was. And he just loved music. He never stopped loving music. And all he ever talked about was music and art. And he said, I'm so lucky I do two things with my time. I paint and I sing.
Goodbye. Music journalist Jonathan Wingate on his memories of Tony Bennett, who's died at the age of 96. And that's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back this time tomorrow. This edition was mixed by Mike Campbell and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.